Thanks very much. I want to say, just for starters, how overwhelmed I feel to see the Georges here. You know, I got kicked out. The Israelis didn't want me to be in Palestine. They sent me away. They said I was never welcome to come back. And one of the most devastating things about that for me is that I wasn't going to get to see my friends anymore that live in Palestine. And to see the Georges here in New York, it's just, it just makes it so much better to be in this room right now, actually. So thanks for coming here.
Thanks for having us.
So I'll start at the end and move backwards a little bit. I was deported 2 days ago from Israel. I wasn't charged with anything except for that the judge accused me of conspiring with the enemy because I took food inside the church nativity. I wasn't officially arrested, but I was put in a prison for 4 days after being in a jail for 3 days. I wasn't given any access to telephones, so I couldn't tell people what was really happening. And the U.S. consulate didn't really want to have much to do with me. I had already, I think, made them angry a month before when they told me that I had to evacuate the refugee camp in Bethlehem because the Israelis were going to bomb it. And I said no. A lot of us were there and said no, we wouldn't leave. I think they were just sick of all of us. Anyway, when I got into the church, it was after trying at different points for the last month. The Palestinians inside the church were surrounded by Israeli snipers, by tanks, and APCs. It was impossible to get even close to the major square where the Church of Nativity is. The Palestinians inside didn't have food. They didn't have proper water or electricity. They had no chance, really, of getting out without being arrested or killed. And some of them inside were killed, and a lot of them inside were arrested. This deal that was made, which is really, you know, no deal at all, smacks of the travesty of Oslo, actually, said that 13 of the Palestinians were going to be sent, exiled, to Cyprus, and from there they would be sent off to who knows where. These people were accused of being terrorists, and they were people who shared the crumbs of food that they had with me, that made sure that I had a blanket, let me sleep near them so that I could feel safe, made sure that I didn't go into any areas where the Israeli snipers could shoot me. They looked out for me like I was their sister, like I was their friend. And one man who was inside there, who's now sitting in Cyprus, now facing extradition back to Israel, where they want to imprison all of those people and renege on this deal. He traded his pin with me, so I was able to get out of the country, out of Israel, with one little Palestinian flag on my sweater. And it made it through strict searches at the hands of the Israelis, searches of all of my possessions, destruction of all of my film and mini discs. I feel really good about that. One thing was able to come out with me. As far as our information is concerned, what we wanted to do to let people know, just documenting, our film was pulled out of our cameras by the Israeli soldiers. Our mini disc was smashed. Our videotapes were stolen. They want to make sure that nobody knows what's happening there. That was just coming out of the church. Earlier when I was in Nablus, a similar thing happened where I was thrown against the wall while my friends were being beaten up because I was on a cell phone telling somebody that we were being attacked by the soldiers. And they searched us all for cameras there, and pulled out all of our film. They really don't want anybody to know what's going on. And so I may have been deported, which was my nightmare, the last thing I wanted to have happen, because I want to be able to go back. But I'm glad that we have this opportunity to talk to people, and it's so nice that there's so many people here. So thanks for coming. Back to the church. There are 26 people. What their punishment is to be sent to Gaza. And Gaza, as you know, is an occupied territory and a place where if you get sent there as a Palestinian, you can't go to the West Bank. Most of the Palestinians that were inside the church, the people that were so good to me, who have families that live in Bethlehem and in the West Bank, whose friends live there, whose legs are there, are now in Gaza where they have no chance of ever returning to the West Bank. They have no chance of getting out of Gaza. Gaza is effectively a prison. It's the border is not porous at all. There are fences made of wire and concrete that surround it. There are Israeli soldiers heavily, heavily armed up and down the fences. There's no way for anybody to get in or out of that place without going through a very strict checkpoint. And as an international, it's the only reason that that there was any movement at that border that day, because I walked through there with my American passport, and after a search and after questioning, they let me go through. So the Palestinians that have been sent there have lost their lives, and they have to rebuild them now in this place that is 43 kilometers long, and it can take up to 2 days to get from one end to the other. A trip that should be, 40 minutes. The Israeli soldiers have it divided into three parts. So if you want to get through a checkpoint, you sit and you wait. You can't walk through the checkpoints. You'll get shot if you get within 200 meters of the checkpoint. You sit in your car. If you don't have a car, you jump in somebody else's just to pass through. I got through in the back of a truck that was delivering macaroni. That truck, the back of it, was crammed full of 20 Palestinians that were trying to get through this checkpoint. I was one of the lucky people that day that I was trying to pass through, because I only had to wait for 5 hours. So imagine if you wanted to go to school, or you had a job, or you wanted to see your family. There's no way that you could without risking never, this huge wait or not getting through it all. There are people that live in Gaza City who have not been out of Gaza City because they're afraid that if they leave, they'll never make it back. There's a group of girls that lived in the apartment above where I stayed whose families live in the south in the refugee camps, that get bombed every day, shot at, and the kids get shot at every day. They can't go home. They have to stay in this apartment in Gaza City without their families, with very little money because their fathers aren't able to work anymore because they can't get to their jobs. And they live there so that they can go to school. And until they get out of school, they're gonna have to stay there. And once they get out, who knows if they'll be able to make it back in to the south to see their families at all. A woman who works for an NGO in Gaza City said that she hasn't seen her parents since last year because she's afraid that if she goes to visit them in the south of Gaza, 40 kilometers from where she lives, that she won't be able to get home again to where her husband and her child live. The Israelis have effectively shut down any sort of life that people can live, that they should be able to live. Any sort of humanitarian international law is ignored. Obviously, we know UN resolutions 242, 338, and 194 are completely ignored. The simple daily life, like simply being able to pass from one place to the next, a trip that should take less than an hour, is impossible. And this is a daily life in Gaza. Gaza didn't experience the huge incursion that the West Bank did while we were there, while I was there. So what I saw in Gaza is just the daily life. This is just what life is under the occupation. people not being able to get food, not being able to get medicine, ambulances not being able to pass through the checkpoint, people dying every single day simply because they're not allowed freedom of movement. The refugee camps are surrounded by soldiers on the side who taunt the children, who then shoot the kids in the legs or kill them. A little boy was killed when I was there. He was playing soccer. He was shot by a sniper because he was a Palestinian boy. He was about 10. In a camp next to that one, I saw the bullet holes in the living room of the family that I was visiting. They had been shot at when the granddaughter was there playing in front of the grandmother who was sitting in the chair, and she showed me the bullet holes right above where her head was. There's a sniper post that's been put in place, so it shoots straight into the camp where the people try to live. So they can't walk out of their houses. They can't cross the street. The people who live across the street can't sleep in their bedroom because it's too dangerous. When I was in the Aza camp, which is in Bethlehem, right at the beginning of when I arrived in Palestine, which was in March, there was an alleyway that maybe some of you've seen, some of the other people speak. They were there too, and so maybe they've talked to you about this, but there's one alleyway where there's a sniper post set up in Gila settlement, which is an illegal Israeli settlement, and they shoot straight into the camp. So the first day we got there, we got taught how to duck down and run as fast as we could across an alleyway that's this wide. Because if we didn't duck and run, we would be shot. And we got shot at. They indiscriminately fire at people. The people that live in the houses that line this alleyway can't walk out their doors. They are under siege all the time. A girl who was 14 opened the front door of her house. She took half a step out and she was shot and killed by a sniper just for walking out her door. The soldiers surrounded the camp. They flew over in the Apache helicopters. The tanks rolled around the outside. The F-16s flew over. And the family that I was living with would jump up, depending on what the explosion sounded like, and run into another room. Because if they stayed in the first room, it wasn't safe, and we could all get killed. Just trying to walk from the stairwell into someone's apartment that was above, we had to duck and run. This is just like trying to walk throughout your house. People aren't safe from the bullets of the Israelis. When I was in Nablus, there were people in the hospital. I remember three different stories from people in the hospital. And one was a woman who was shot because she looked out her window. Another was someone who was walking from her kitchen to her living room and she was shot in the stomach. These are people just in their homes. Another man lost his daughter and his wife and was injured himself because their house was shot at while they were inside their house. There's story after story like that I heard while I was in West Bank in Gaza. I was in Jenin refugee camp, which is really just a pile of rubble at this point. There are children that are playing on top of the rubble while the bodies of their family members are getting pulled out. Kids that don't have parents anymore, that don't have a house anymore. The dust was so thick because of the rubble that visibility was about 5 feet for a lot of the time. And the only places where there was any moisture on the ground at all was from where the sewage lines were ruptured. And so it was just soaked with sewage. There was no water that was clean. A lot of the people, there's no food, of course, except for what people could get from the city of Jenin, which was also really damaged and shut down for most of the time. There was no electricity, of course. There's absolutely no infrastructure. The Israelis targeted the infrastructure to make sure that regular life can't resume. They may pull out of the center of the town, but they still surround the town, and so supplies can't get in, repairs can't be done. People's lives can't go on. I saw the inside of people's houses in the Jenin camp, the ones that still had four walls. So a lot of the houses were just split in two. You could see people like sitting on different floors of their houses, trying to live, like, just trying to sit in their house because they didn't have anywhere else to go. But, you know, there's no wall anymore. And half of it's falling down. But inside one of the houses that the Israeli soldiers occupied while the camp was being bombed, who used the house as a sniper post to shoot at the Palestinians who tried to escape from their houses while they were being bombed. There were piles of clothes all over the place. Many were burned. There were children's toys that were torn apart. There were cans of old cans of food from the soldiers. There was excrement all over the place. And lipstick taken from the woman who lived in the house and on the mirror in the bedroom. And in the bathroom, they had drawn Stars of David. Inside the mosque in the camp, there were bullet holes all the way around on the inside. The collection boxes were broken into. The windows were smashed out. There was a water tower up top, which was full of bullet holes. Every water tower I saw was full of bullet holes. And in the basement of the mosque, there was a preschool. And it had murals of little girls all the way around the main room of the preschool. And the soldiers had taken some, you know, a knife or whatever, I don't know it, but they had gouged out the eyes of every little girl that was in these murals. Back to Nablus for a second. The old city of Nablus looks similar to parts of Jenin camp. It's piles and piles of rubble. There was a church where somebody said, I think there are 14 or 15 people under there. When I was there, there were three bodies that were pulled out of the house. The camps around Nablus were under curfew longer than the city. And so when you were hearing that the troops had left Nablus, they hadn't. They were preventing anyone from getting in or out of the camps. They were still bombing the camps. There was one night where I couldn't sleep for a second, even if I had been able to, just because it was so loud. And this is when they said there were no troops there anymore. It was bombed all night long. And the next day, we tried to bring some food and some medicine and get into that camp. We were shot at by soldiers who said that if we took another step forward, they would kill us and that they would have no choice but to do so. The Palestinians that we were with, who, like most who I encountered, were much more concerned with my safety than with theirs, said, no, no, let's go back. They were all medics and doctors and volunteers at the Union of Palestinian Medical Relief Committees. And so we turned back and passed another camp that we had brought some food into earlier. And just trying to walk, it should have been a 5-minute walk, we got stopped by soldiers. Just to generally, you know, harass and intimidate us, like what Palestinians have to go through every day if they encounter an Israeli soldier, which is very often because they're everywhere. They held us for 2 hours, saying, oh, just 5 more minutes, just 5 more minutes. And after the second hour, 7 tanks showed up, 5 APCs, and two Israeli police jeeps. There were probably 24 soldiers, I'm not really sure how many. We were still trying to negotiate just a passage. We were going 5 minutes from here, just up the street. They told us that if the international separated from the Palestinians, that we could go. That we could go get our bags, and that we could leave Nablus, because we weren't welcome there. Nablus is the Palestinian city. We refused, of course, to leave the Palestinians and to get our bags. And the soldiers rushed the crowd, beating people. It's hard to describe because it was so crazy and going so fast. And this is what Palestinians had to deal with all the time. And I only had to deal with it once, but it was totally crazy what they did. They went nuts on us. They were hitting us with their guns. They were kicking people. They had one guy, like two soldiers, holding his arms out, and another soldier's boot went down right on his face. Three soldiers grabbed one kid who couldn't weigh more than 100 pounds and drug him into the street and were kicking him and his whole body. They attacked me because I was on the telephone telling somebody what was happening. They took the Palestinians that were still with us that they hadn't already drug off by the hair. They jumped over us to get to them and drug them off. They put them in handcuffs and kept beating them. People's faces were covered in blood. And there were two girls, one was 15 and one was 16. And they were crying. They were volunteers for the medics. They were so scared, and they were just in a little pile on the ground, and we were on top of them trying to make sure that the soldiers couldn't get them. And all they did was sob. This is their life. I want to tell you a little bit more about some of the people inside the church, because I know that my time is about up. And there's so many stories to tell. There's so much stuff like this that goes on. But we need to have as many witnesses as possible. If everyone in this room could go buy a plane ticket, it would be a good time to do it. inside the church, I know that that the corporate media was reporting that they were bad people, terrorists, all that kind of stuff. I just want to talk just a little bit about how much humanity was shown to me by these people who are supposedly bad, who are accused of resisting the occupation, and accused of resisting in such a way that they actually didn't do. One man's friends were sent away. He's left in Bethlehem. One's sent to Gaza. One is sent to Cyprus. They broke the unbreakable, he told us. When people were taken away, they were crying. They were hugging. It was one of the most devastating things to watch. These people's lives being completely ripped apart because they took this deal that was supposed to mean some sort of peace. And a lot of the people inside of the church said, fine, I'll be anywhere except for here. I can't stand being in this hell anymore. That church became a hell. And even inside of that, like in all of that hell, people's eyes were still bright. Like they were holding on some sort of hope. They were still kind to each other. They were still loving. They still laughed. One guy, maybe I told you about this. I don't even know when I talked about this. But one of the most wanted, supposedly, was a Palestinian policeman who gave me his keffiyeh because I was cold. He thought that the deal was maybe going to be a good thing. He was so excited at the possibility that he was going to get to see his 12 kids and his wife. He shaved his 32-day beard off. He did his hand wash in the well and was hanging it up and was smiling. And he got shot in the left lung and he didn't make it more than an hour. Amongst the internationals inside the church, there was one woman from Ireland who was a nurse. And she said that if they had had this simplest medication, that she could have saved his life. And that kind of thing happened over and over and over. The ambulances were targeted. The doctors are targeted. Ambulance drivers were arrested, stripped down to their underpants, made to stand in the hot sun while soldiers shot around their bodies. That happened in Nablus over and over. The ambulances themselves are riddled with bullet holes. The windows are shot out. The tires get shot, the tires get replaced because they got to go back out in them. One man who worked for the medics in Nablus was arrested every single day that I was there. I was there for 6 days, and he had already been arrested several times in a row before that. This is for being an ambulance driver. He was prevented almost every time from picking up the person he was trying to get. He would be held from between 2 and 6 hours. And every day he would get back to the center, sit down for a second, try to take a breath, and go get back in the ambulance to try to get somebody out of the camp again, or get somebody from one part of Nablus to the other, just to go to the hospital. The ambulance was also used as a food delivery truck, because even though the ambulances were shot at in the way that they were, all the other cars were smashed to bits. They were rolled over by tanks. And so there was no possibility of making any sort of deliveries in the town. And the people can't be walking on the streets. They get shot and killed if they're on the streets. So one ambulance was used in the middle of the night to pick up bread from a house where Palestinians baked bread 24 hours a day. So we would go there in the middle of the night and pick up the bread and deliver it to different places. So into the city of Nablus, under siege, at least people had some bread to eat. There were clandestine water deliveries. When I arrived in Nablus, sneaking through the hills to get there, hiding from tanks because the Israelis didn't want us to go into Nablus, we saw one water truck. And it was just this like old truck, and it dumped water into buckets for the people who would sneak out of their houses and go to the truck. So people had some bread and some water. And this is in one of the oldest cities in the world, one of the most beautiful places that might have been. Anyway, 2,000 years gone in 5 minutes, as somebody much more eloquent than I has said. So my time is up, and I'm happy that you're all here and in Palestine.